The orders of the clerk now today are on file in the clerk's office and available for your inspection there. Three clauses will be submitted today. In the order in which they will be presented, they are as follows. William J. Williams versus George Kalop from Harris County. Payne & Keller Incorporated versus PPG Industries Incorporated from Jefferson County. And Margaret U. Williams and David E. Williams versus Stephen Glash from Harris County. All three of these clauses will be submitted before we recess for lunch, but we will take a brief recess in between the presentation of each clause. Counsel in the second and third clauses do not have to remain in the courtroom while earlier matters are being argued, but we ask that you remain nearby so that we can proceed to your calls without delay in the event that earlier arguments should finish before time. Counsel in all three clauses are advised that these arguments are being recorded for the convenience of the court. You may make application with our clerk's office should you wish to hear the tapes of these arguments. In the first clause, Williams v. Kalop, the petitioner is allowed 20 minutes to present oral argument, the respondent 20 minutes for rebuttal, and the petitioner is allowed 10 minutes. Excuse me, let me start over. Petitioner 20 minutes for argument, respondent 20 minutes for argument, the petitioner 10 minutes for rebuttal. The court is ready to hear oral argument from petitioner.
May it please the court, Mr. Kevin DeVos to present argument for the petitioner.
May it please the court. My name is Kevin DeVos. I represent the petitioner, a man named Bill Williams. This case presents one issue on appeal, and it's the question of first impression. That issue concerns the interpretation of Section 16.068 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code. That statute involves the application of the statute of limitations to amended pleadings, and the two parties to this appeal present two distinctly different interpretations of that statute. Our interpretation, based on the language of the statute, is this, that if an original pleading is timely filed, then any subsequent amendment to that pleading is also timely filed as long as it does not involve different facts or circumstances. The respondent's theory of this statute is called the relation back doctrine, and what they argue is that an amended pleading should be treated as if it were filed on the date of the first pleading for purposes of statute of limitations. Now, in most cases, these two theories produce the same result, but a difference arises when the two pleadings, the original pleading and the amended pleading, are based on different theories of liability that have different statutes of limitations, and the original pleading is filed in between those two dates. The best way to explore this possible problem is to look at the facts of this case. This case originally arose as a business dispute between Mr. Caliph and Mr. Williams. Mr. Caliph was a businessman and entrepreneur who wanted to build a country and western nightclub in Houston back in 1980. He engaged the services of my client, Mr. Williams, a building contractor. About halfway through construction, the two had a falling out and their business relationship was terminated. The first suit that was filed in October of 1980 was Mr. Caliph suing Mr. Williams. Mr. Williams responded in October of 1980 with a simple answer. In 1983, Williams filed a counterclaim. That counterclaim was based on breach of contract. The statute of limitations for breach of contract is plainly 4 years. So in 1983, that original pleading based on breach of contract was timely filed. Then in 1986, Mr. Williams amended his pleading. He kept the breach of contract theory and added a cause of action based on fraud. Same facts, just a different theory of liability. The case went to trial to a jury. The jury found that Caliph was liable on the counterclaim for both breach of contract and fraud. They awarded $185,000 for damages and fraud in response to a separate damage question about breach of contract in an apparent attempt to avoid double recovery. They did not award any damages for breach of contract. So the sole recovery for which Williams was awarded recovery at trial was the fraud theory. The Court of Appeals reversed the decision of the trial court, entering judgment for Williams, and rendered judgment that Williams take nothing because his suit was barred by the statute of limitations. Now let's look at the two theories of the two parties that apply to this case. Taylor's theory is that because the fraud cause of action was an amendment to an original pleading filed in 1983, 3 years after the event, And because Caleb argues that the statute of limitations for fraud is 2 years, he says if you treat that pleading as if it were filed on the date of the original pleading, then the cause of action is barred by limitations. What the statute says, however, in our interpretation of it, is that if an original pleading is timely filed, and this one unquestionably was, then any amendment to that pleading based on the same facts is also timely filed. So the two theories produce distinctly different results in this factual scenario, so this court is forced to make a decision about which interpretation to apply. To assist the court in that task, I offer three arguments. The first is that the language of the statute is plain and unambiguous, and therefore no statutory interpretation based on speculation about legislative intent is appropriate. Plain, unambiguous language, legislative intent speculation is inappropriate. Our second argument is that the so-called relation back doctrine is not found anywhere in the language of 16.068. Relation back doctrine is not found in the statute. And thirdly, allowing this cause of action based on a literal reading of the statute does not frustrate the purpose behind statutes of limitations. Now return to that first argument. The statute says what it says in plain and unambiguous language. The best place to go for that is the statute itself. Section 16.068, it is reproduced on page 3 of my brief and also on page 3 of the First Court of Appeals opinion. That statute allows for several different possibilities, so it may be confusing when reading it in relation to all of these possibilities. I will read the parts of the statute that apply to this particular case. The statute says, if a pleading relates to a counterclaim that is not subject to a pleading of limitation when the pleading is filed, subsequent amendment or supplement to the pleading that changes the grounds of liability is not subject to a plea of limitation, unless the amendment or supplement is wholly based on a new, distinct, or different transaction or occurrence. Now, in this case, there has never been any allegation that they were based on a different transaction or occurrence. They're the same facts, just different theories of liability. And what the statute plainly says is if the first pleading, the one filed in 1983, is not subject to a plea of limitations, then the amended pleading is also not subject to a plea of limitations. The language of the statute is plain and unambiguous, and our rules of statutory construction say that when language is plain and unambiguous, it is improper to resort to extrinsic means of statutory interpretation. The First Court of Appeals, in its opinion, referred to the statute but said, surely that's not what the legislature intended. That kind of speculation about legislative intent is simply not appropriate. Even if statutory construction were required because of unclear language, we also have rules of statutory construction that say that when legislative intent is considered, it must be gleaned from the language of the statute. And the statute itself has no language that supports the theory suggested by the respondent. That leads me to my second argument, that the relation back doctrine, urged by Caleb and adopted by the First Court of Appeals erroneously, has no support in the language of the statute itself. Now, I just read the statute, and the statute says nothing about treating an amended pleading as if it were filed on the date of the first pleading. And surely if the legislature wanted to write a statute like that, they could have. But that's not found anywhere in the language of the statute. Where does support for this theory come from? Well, there are two types of cases that have announced this doctrine, two recent cases and several older cases. The two recent cases were both cases out of the Dallas Court of Appeals in 1985, both written by the same justice as Justice Allen, in which he uses language about relation back and about treating an amended pleading as if it were filed on the date of the first pleading. He cites the statute, but the statute simply doesn't say that. In those cases, it made no difference whether you followed the rule of the statute or the relation back doctrine. The result was the same, so that court was not called upon to make a choice between the two, so his language about the relation back doctrine is merely dicta. Furthermore, even if it were not dicta, if it were the holding, we submit that that is simply wrong. It is simply not supported by the language of the statute. There is no basis for this relation back theory, despite those two recent Dallas Court of Appeals opinions.
Counsel, if you had non-suited the first case and then refiled another suit with the second ground, would this problem be a problem at all?
If the non-suit were filed prior to the amendment, I'm not sure. The statute talks about an amended pleading, an original pleading and an amended one. I suppose if the first one was non-suited, then the second one would not be an amended pleading. It would be a new pleading, and then we have a different analysis. So I don't think that would be the same. There are some older cases from the 1930s in which the courts used language about the filing of an original pleading tolling the statute or arresting the statute or staying the statute. Those cases were all from the 1930s. The predecessor of Section 16.068 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code is Article 5539B of the Texas Revised Civil Statute. That statute was enacted in 1931. And even though some of these 1930s cases were decided after the enactment of the statute, they either involved facts that occurred before 1931, or the court simply refused to apply the recently enacted statute for whatever reason. But none of those cases that talks in language about tolling or arresting or staying the statute make any mention of Article 5539B. They are common law cases. They make no attempt to interpret the statute, which a successor statute is now before the court. Our third argument is that allowing this cause of action based on the language of the statute does not frustrate the purpose behind statutes of limitations. Now, in the first Court of Appeals opinion, the court stated, cited a case from this court saying that the primary purpose of a statute of limitations is to compel the exercise of a right within a reasonable time so that the opposite party has a fair opportunity to defend while witnesses are available and the evidence is fresh in their minds. So the purpose behind the statute of limitations is someone is not prejudiced by losing either evidence or witnesses. Now let's look at the facts of this case. The facts involved in this counterclaim based on fraud filed in 1986 are the same facts that were involved in the original counterclaim for breach of contract in 1983 and the same facts involved in the original cause of action filed in 1980. So to the extent that Mr. Califf needed to preserve evidence or witnesses, he had every reason to do that back in 1980. He was not an unknown, unsuspecting defendant who was surprised by this suit in 1986. The suit had been pending for a long time. All of the same evidence and same witnesses would have been required since back in 1980. It was merely a shift in the grounds of liability. So in this case, there is no prejudice from allowing the 1986 counterclaim. That's not unique to this case, however, because the last sentence of Article 16.068 takes that into account, because it says the subsequent pleading is not barred by limitations as long as it is based on the same set of facts or circumstances. So that in any case, if it's based on the same facts or circumstances, the defendant in the subsequent pleading is not going to be prejudiced because those same facts and circumstances have already been involved in the litigation process and there's no concern about losing evidence or losing witnesses. So for these three reasons then, because the language of the statute is plain and unambiguous and requires no statutory construction, because the relation back theory is not found anywhere in the statute at all, and because allowing this cause of action based on the language of the statute does not frustrate the purpose of the statute of limitations in this case or as a general rule in other cases, we respectfully request that this court reverse the decision of the First Court of Appeals and reinstate the judgment of the trial court in favor of Mr. Williams.
The problem is not frustration of the basic purpose of limitations. The problem is the folly in having a statute of limitations for a cause of action that somehow is reduced by simply amending a pleading. Why should that be? Why should the legislature have been thought to have intended that?
Well, first of all, the legislature's intention is clearly expressed in the statute. Regardless of their reasons for doing it, I think the language of the statute is clear.
Even if they say black equals red.
I'm sorry, I don't understand your question.
Well, if the contradiction is as plain as that, your argument is that's nevertheless their intention?
If the legislature passed a statute that says that, I suppose that would be true. It's not that kind of situation, though. I think their rule is pretty clear from their statute. With regard to the argument that we have in effect reduced the statute of limitations for fraud, again, the problem is whether or not anybody is harmed by that. and if the facts and circumstances being alleged in the fraud pleading are already in the litigation process, then there is no harm by reducing the statute of limitations.
Well, whether there was harm or not, if you hadn't had a breach of contract action, you could not have brought a fraud action originally as a counterclaim.
Well, that's subject to question, because there's some question about what the appropriate statute of limitations for fraud is. If it is 2 years, which I don't think that it is, then that's correct.
Why aren't you urging that it's a four-year statute up here? Do you believe you've waived that below?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I've struggled with that question, obviously, and that's why I put it in the lap of the court for the court to decide. It's clear that if I had not briefed a point of error, I could not raise a point of error that has not been briefed. My point of error is that the Court of Appeals erred in holding this cause of action was barred by limitations. And this is another reason for that point of error. I'm in effect asking the court to take judicial notice of a statute. So I don't think that I've waived it. It was not in my original brief. It was in a supplemental letter brief, so I do think it's before the court. And if that's the case, if the statute of limitations for fraud is 4 years, as I think the statute clearly indicates that it is, then this whole question is moot.
But do you agree, if a plaintiff, for example, brought a cause of action which was had a subject to a 2-year statute of limitations and more than 2 years had transpired since the action accrued, that he could not do so, and yet if he named in that pleading a cause of action that was subject to a 4-year limitation, he could not join in that cause of action the other one that was barred, but he could the next day amend his pleadings and incorporate that action?
That is theoretically possible.
And likewise with the defendant, he could not bring a counterclaim that was barred by limitations, but he could bring one that was not barred and then the next day amend.
That is theoretically possible, Your Honor.
All right. What sense does that make?
Well, the solution to that problem is Article 13 relating to frivolous pleadings. And if somebody does that solely for the purpose of circumventing the statute, they would be subject to sanctions, including dismissal, and I think that would be appropriate. And that's the solution to that problem. And if this, again, we go back to the question of whether there's any harm. If there is still a possibility that a person is subject to a 4-year cause of action, and that cause of action is brought legitimately, and in this case that was done, the jury found that he was liable for breach of contract. It was not a means to circumvent the statute. If somebody does that illegitimately, then they're subject to sanctions under Rule 13, and that's the solution to that problem.
But as your case points out, the case where you could not state causes of action both for breach of contract and fraud would be the exception, not the rule.
I'm sorry, could you repeat?
In most cases, if you could state a cause of action for breach of contract, you could probably state one for fraud.
That's probably true.
So the cases to which this rule would apply would be most of them, and the frivolous rule case would just probably not come up.
Well, again, we go to whether the person was doing that solely for the purpose of circumventing the statute. And if they were, regardless of whether there was a breach of contract that existed, if they did that and the next day filed for fraud and then went to trial only on the fraud pleading, I think the sanctions would be appropriate.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is arguing from respondent.
That's
the May it please the court, Mr. Paul Rosen will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court, my name is Paul Rosen and I represent George Caleb, the respondent in this application. Learned Counsel references three reasons why you should find for the applicant in this writ of error. I'd like to work backwards on those three arguments and particularly pay attention to the last question that was asked. Counsel presented to this court or suggested to this court that finding in favor and interpreting the statute literally as he tells us it should be would not frustrate the purpose.
Do you agree that if you read this statute literally, it cuts against your position in this case?
I would agree that at first impression that would be the case. However, I would point out that this court, as well as numerous court of appeals, has struggled with this question before. And for example, there is a case, Brown versus Owens, a Texas Supreme Court case in 1984, where the court actually went in and spent time interpreting the word. And another case, Hunt the Heaton, a Beaumont case, also went about interpreting the word shall. Now, shall is a simple word, at least in my in-person impression to me. Shall is a mandatory word, and has always been held to be a mandatory word. Yet, in the proper circumstance, in looking at the proper statute, in looking at the legislative intent, in both those two cases, the court found different from the obvious of the meaning of shall, and found shall not to be mandatory. So, yes, I would agree that at first blush, the literal reading of that goes against the grain of what I'm presenting to this court. Getting back to the frustration of purpose. In fact, to find for the appellant in this matter would lead to absurd results and would totally frustrate and indeed would eliminate statute of limitations in and of themselves. For example, counselor raises Article 13, and I think we're talking Rule 13 as the Texas Rule of Civil Procedure on frivolous pleadings. First, let's look at Rule 13. Rule 13 says that if you file a pleading and it's frivolous, you could be sanctioned if you don't dismiss it within 60 days. It does not provide for automatic sanction just for the mere filing of it. So what happens? Let's take the absurd or the unusual circumstance, but we could open a floodgate and literally do away with all statute of limitations. Take the common cause of action of negligence. We miss a 2-year statute in an automobile accident. 2 years and 6 months go by, and a bright attorney sits back and says, well, listen, the man that was driving the other vehicle, he had a driver's license. That license was a contract with the state that he's going to abide by the laws of the state of Texas as far as how he should drive his vehicle. I filed a lawsuit for breach of contract as a third-party beneficiary under that contract. That's not so frivolous. It's not such an unusual idea. Obviously, it wouldn't hold up. One day later, I amend for negligence. I have effectively done away with the statute of limitations on negligence. Now, that's the unusual circumstance, and agree, I have to go through stretching in order to come up with an artful cause of action for breach of contract to do that. But I would point out that the history of law in this state, dating back to as early as 1911, and in which I cited one case in the brief, but there are numerous others, specifically state that no matter how inartful reads, no matter whether it states a true cause of action or not, whether it's subject to demur, makes no difference as relates to this particular concept. It makes no difference at all. You still have the right to amend at any time and do that.
Well, you have not eliminated statutes of limitations. You just extended them all to 4 years.
That would be correct. You effectively eliminate the 2-year statute absolutely off the book.
So when you say you would totally frustrate and indeed eliminate statute's limitation, that's a little exaggerated. It would only be extending them all 4 years.
Well, I guess I could try to come up with circumstances that the 4-year could also be eliminated because there are 10-year statute of limitations and there are limitations in real property cases, although I don't know that that would really be applicable. But certainly the 10-year statute may come into effect with contractors and engineers, etc. That is possible that that could have that effect to extend that. But in any event, the principal issue, while it's the interpretation of 16068 of the Civil Practice and Remedy Code, there's an underlying issue here, and that deals with statute construction. And as I mentioned earlier, the Texas Supreme Court has, in the past, found ways to interpret a statute according to the real intent. And they get this based on the government code, section 312.005, where the legislature instructed the court, in effect, by stating, I quote, in interpreting a statute, a court shall diligently attempt to ascertain legislative intent and shall consider at all times the old law, the evil, and the remedy, unquote. Now, interestingly enough, and I don't believe counsel would have disagreed, there is not one case cited by the appellant in this action that supports this position. Virtually every case is consistent with respondent's theory under the law. Now, it is true that relation back is not literally mentioned in
Were any of those cases decided under this particular provision that you mentioned? Any of your cases?
Dozens. Let me change that. In all candor, this is a case of first impression to one extent. Dozens of cases have interpreted this as tolling, relation back, arresting the limitations from the date of the first filing. It is true, and counselor is correct, when he states the court has never been presented with a circumstance where a pleading was filed in, say, 3 years on a 4-year statute and then amended to bring in a 2-year statute. So that would be a case of first impression. However, I would point out that prior to the enactment of the predecessor to 16.068, we had Article 5539B, which was enacted in 1931. An examination of the case law, and I found cases dating back to 1911. This concept came about by the legislature because of the common law. The courts were already determining in numerous cases. I have cases in 1918, Henderson versus Biggs, and I could supply, if the court wishes, I have numerous cases going right up through 1937 to get the before and after effect. The earlier cases never used the term relation back. And I will admit that it's a newly coined phrase, when I say new, in relation to the time frame we're talking about, perhaps the past 20, 25 years. But they always use the term toll or arrest. And rightfully so. What they were talking about is, once you file one pleading, you can go ahead and amend and bring any other cause of action. And from the date of that first pleading, a limitation is now forever tolled in that particular lawsuit, as long as it's with the same facts, the same transaction. It's told. And how do I come across that interpretation in reading this? Well, it really is very simple. They talk about when a pleading is filed, and then the statute talks about a subsequent amendment. Now, clearly, the plea of limitation that is barred goes from subsequent to the filing. In other words, nothing prevents the statute from ticking daily as we sit here. Once he filed the lawsuit, the clock stopped. So now he can amend, and from that point forward, he can bring any cause of action he wants, but you can't breathe greater life into something. You can't raise something from the dead, and that is precisely what counselor would have you do.
But no cases ever held that until this complaint.
No case has ever held
that you can't breathe life into an expired cause of action if you add it to a live cause of action.
That is correct, Your Honor. However, I would point out that to do so, there is additional contract construction, if I may relate to a particular case that may add some insight to that particular question. It's Texas State Board of Dental Examiners versus Fenlaw. And in that case, they talked about statutes that are, excuse my pronunciation, but I think it's in para materia, or in other words, in relation to the same matter. They talk about different statutes. And it has always been the job of this court, when interpreting the statute, to look at its effect on other statutes and try and ascertain the intent of the legislature. So although it is true there's never been a case that says you can't breathe life into a cause of action that's already died on you, to do so would be, in effect, eliminating the legislature's intent in enacting a 2-year statute in the first place. In that particular case, the court stated that statutes in para materia, in relation to the same matter, be construing all parts. You must take them together, and you must try to carry out the legislative intent and try to make some sense and make harmony out of it. In doing that, and this is a quote, the court stated, interpretation may sometimes vary with literal terms. Now that's not new to this court. In fact, I may quote from a number of cases, some of which are from this court. The Brown versus Owens Texas Supreme Court case. The court stated, strict construction does not mean narrowest meaning. The fundamental rule is to ascertain the legislative intent, and the intent may be enforced even though not entirely consistent with the strict letter of the statute. And in determining the meaning of the word shall in that particular court, the court considered the entire act, its nature, its object, and its consequences.
That's not cited in your brief. Can you go to the shall?
No, it's not. And I'm sorry, Your Honor. That is 674 Southwest 2nd, 748. And another shall case, where the court literally found shall was not mandatory, was a Beaumont case, Hunt v. Heaton, 631 Southwest 2nd, 549. Let me give some further examples of statute construction to show you the extremes the courts will go to in order to protect the conflict between statutes and the true intent of the legislature. In King v. Texas Employees Insurance Association, 716 Southwest 2nd, 181, the Fort Worth Court stated, in construing a statute and the reasonable effect is examined, and when literal enforcement would lead to consequences which are not contemplated, the court will adopt a construction that will promote the purpose of the statute passed. Additionally, grammatically, how far is the court gone? In a Texas Supreme Court case, Popham v. Patterson, 51 Southwest 2nd, 680, the court stated, in construing written laws, courts are not bound by the rules of grammar and may disregard them to give the effect to manifest legislative intent. In McCulloch...
You get the legislative intent solely from the rest of the limitation scheme, not from anything in this section, correct?
That is correct. And in this section, too.
And so your argument depends entirely on statute, on fraud being a two-year statute.
Absolutely, Your Honor. This is moot if this becomes a...
Now, maybe that's been waived, but isn't that something we have to examine?
Okay.
At least in a footnote or something?
Your Honor, I do not believe it's before the court. It clearly is waived in this situation. However, in the interest of justice and the issue, I think it's another issue that is parallel in a lot of ways to 16.068. And that, I mean, that the legislature came up with 16.068 and its predecessor based on the common law, based on what this court was doing and the Court of Appeals were doing prior to that. So they had in mind what they were trying to accomplish. And sometimes they don't do it artfully enough, and you have these literal interpretation problems. I suggest to the court that fraud, the two-year statute, and this new issue that has been waived, is the same thing. In virtually every state that I could find in a cursory review, in the common law, dating back a substantial period of time, fraud has traditionally been a two-year statute, a two-year limitation. Now, it is true that under the statute, the court has sometimes embraced the concept of the written language of the statute, where it talks about verbal contracts and nonverbal contracts, and use that as a basis to hang their hat on a two-year statute of limitations. I presented to the court that I dug deep enough, I found some cases, I could supply it at a later date, that held the two-year statute was applicable for other than that provision in the limitation, two-year statute limitation. It held it under a trespass, under a damage to property, under a damage to person. So if you take the right scenario, the court sometimes uses a legal fiction to do that, but in fact, fraud has always been a two-year statute, should be a two-year statute unless the legislature clearly intends otherwise. And when they amended in 1979, they never intended to change fraud to a four-year statute.
How do we know that?
Well, I guess you would have to examine the legislative intent.
And assuming there's nothing there, which there probably isn't, how do we know that they didn't mean to change fraud and everything else to 4 years? There are lawyers in the legislature, and they're aware of this distinction.
Well, it's interesting, but I think that this two-year statute issue has gone on for 50 years or more. In fact, even under the old statute, my opinion, that it was a legal fiction to find fraud in the two-year statute based on this so-called oral contract. In most fraud situations, there is no true contract, or in lots of fraud situations, there are not.
Actually, technically, it was considered an action for debt.
That brings me to another point. I checked in Prosser and I checked in Keaton, and nowhere in the historical basis of fraud as it arose, which it arose as a tort, we were taught in law school that it developed as a tort. Historically, it was a tort. Nowhere have I ever found in any of the experts, in any of the form books, the term action on debt as related to a fraud. Nowhere is that found. In fact, fraud gets its inception, according to Prosser, from the old common law cause of action of deceit, and had no basis necessarily. Now, that doesn't mean particular facts would apply to an action on a debt, but you can come up with particular facts that can apply on damage to property, damage to a person. Certainly, when you cheat somebody, when you deceive somebody, you're damaging a person.
Isn't limitations necessarily a legislative function?
Yes, it is, Your Honor. And however, the courts have truly interpreted, and always have interpreted what that meant. And again, we're dealing with a history. There's not one case that has ever held fraud to be 4 years. Not one case. It has always been held to be 2 years. And that is post-1979, post this so-called amendment and glitch in the statute where this action on debt, verbal action on debt, was dropped.
How many cases are there since 1979 holding that it's still governed by a two-year statute?
A handful of cases, not that many, Your Honor, but there is a case in Houston, and I believe there's, and I can get the site because I briefly did it. In all fairness, I was hit with the letter on this amendment literally 1 week before this hearing, and it's my contention that that issue is waived as far as this goes. As far as the footnote, I still believe that it was always, the legislature never intended to change a fraud in being encompassed in a two-year statute, and it was simply a glitch in the written language. However, I point out to the court that I think the court, and this court's application traditionally through the years, has shown that to be a problem. It's a legal fiction to call all fraud actions an action on a debt. It's truly a legal fiction. There's no basis on it historically. There's no basis of it through any of the textbooks or form books or the experts. A couple of more points on how far the courts will go. In McCulloch versus Fox and Jacobs, 696 Southwest 2nd 918, a court stated, the Dallas court stated, a reviewing court is not confined to the literal meaning of the words used in the statute, but must consider that which is implied as well as that which is expressed. And again, in Troutman versus DPS, 416 Southwest 2nd 539, the Austin court stated, when the purpose of the statute is ascertained, the significance of words used may be restricted or enlarged in order to effectuate that purpose and to give the statute the meaning which the lawmakers manifestly intended. Now, again, I refer the court back to section 312.005 of the Government Code, which expressly states in interpreting its statute, a court shall diligently attempt to ascertain not only legislative intent, but shall also consider the old law, the evil, and the remedy. The old law predates the legislature in 1931 and has always been consistent on tolling the statute. And the remedy, the evil that would occur will obviously be opening up a floodgate of litigation, eliminating the two-year statute. And I thank the court for the courtesy in allowing me to finish the sentence.
Any questions? Thank you, counsel.
May I please the court? I will address 3 points on rebuttal. First, the existence of case law concerning the issue now before the court. Second, rules about statutory construction. And third, arguments regarding the statute of limitations on fraud. First, regarding case law, respondent argues that there is not a single case in Texas jurisprudence that supports our position. As indicated previously, this is a question of first impression. There are no cases either one of us has been able to find that confronts this exact problem and says one way or another, whether you follow the language of the statute or you follow the judge-made relation back doctrine. There's simply no cases one way or the other. There is dicta in several cases, and I've talked about cases cited by the respondent last time, And there are other cases which indicta support a literal reading of the statute. One of those cases was a case cited in respondent's brief called Leonard versus Texaco, a 1967 decision of this court. In that case, the court said that the predecessor to this statute, Article 5539B, expressly provides that an amendment to a pleading shall not be subject to a plea of limitation where the amendment is not wholly based on or grows out of a new, distinct, or different transaction or occurrence. Doesn't say anything about relation back or tolling the statute. It says if the first one is timely filed, the second one is timely filed. Another case from 1988 from the Houston First Court of Appeals, Adams versus Petrade International. This case is at 754 Southwest 2nd, 696. 754-696. In that case, the Court of Appeals said, again, if an amended pleading relates to the cause of action asserted in the original petition that is not subject to limitations, then the amendment is also not barred by limitations. Those cases read the statute the way the language of the statute reads and says if the first one is not barred, then the second one is not barred.
Do you agree with the opposing counsel that these precise facts are a question of first impression?
I do, Your Honor.
You do know that Adams is pending appeal.
I do not know that, Your Honor. The second argument made regarding the case law is that respondent argues that common law cases support this relation back theory, and when the statute was enacted in 1931, it was meant to enact the common law. Again, the Leonard versus Texaco case, 1967 case out of this court, says that that's not true. In that case, this court talked about the 1931 Act, enacting Article 5539B, and said the emergency clause of the 1931 Act referred to the importance of simplifying court procedure and evidenced an intention to effect some change in the law as it theretofore existed. This court is not bound by the common law prior to the 1931 statute or its predecessor. In that opinion, the court indicated there was meant to be a change in the law, and that's what resulted. Secondly, regarding statutory construction, respondent says the Government Code 312.005 says the court should consider legislative intent. There are numerous cases in this state, some cited in my brief, that say that when considering legislative intent, the court is bound by the language of the statute itself. The statute is fairly brief. The court can examine the language of the statute. There is nothing that can conceivably be interpreted to adopt a rule of relation back or tolling the statute. Counsel suggests that the court has broad leeway in interpreting statutes. They can even disagree over words such as shall. They aren't bound by punctuation. The court can do pretty much whatever it wants to interpret a statute to reach a result. I think that overstates the case a little bit. But what counsel never does say is how this court can interpret this statute so that it means relating back that you treat an amended petition as if it were filed on the date of the first petition. Now, it may be the opinion that this would be a better rule, and perhaps it is the task of the legislature to amend the statute to change the rule. But there is no conceivable way to interpret this language of this statute to achieve the result that respondent desires. Finally, regarding the argument about statute of limitations for fraud actually being 4 years now instead of 2 years. Counsel suggests that that argument has been waived because it was not raised to him until 1 week before oral argument. It was actually served upon him 2 weeks ago today. Before that, the day I wrote the letter, I called him and told him the letter was coming, took him a rough draft, and took him a final draft by hand delivery so he would have as much notice as possible. He said that the legislature did not intend to change the statute of limitations for fraud from 2 years to 4 years. The legislature previously had two statutes that talked about actions on a debt, and there are numerous cases saying fraud is an action on a debt. Before 1979, the two-year statute applied to actions on a debt evidenced by writing, and the four-year statute applied to actions on a debt evidenced by writing. In 79, the legislature eliminated the distinction and put all actions for debt in the four-year statute. I don't see how you can argue the legislature did that inadvertently. They made a conscious decision to make the statute of limitations for all actions on debts 4 years rather than two. Counsel says this is not an action on a debt. It's more like a tort. If it's not an action on a debt, then there's a statute of limitations that says if not specifically mentioned in any other statute of limitations, then the statute of limitations is 4 years. So either it's an action on a debt and it's 4 years, or it's not an action on a debt, and it's not specifically mentioned anywhere, and it's 4 years. Finally, counsel says that since that amendment in 1979, there have been no cases that have applied the new 4-year rule of statute of limitations for fraud. That is true. All the cases that I could find except one were based on facts that arose prior to 1979.
But there is one.
There is one case, Your Honor. It's a Court of Appeals case, and it cites a 1940s Supreme Court case that says statute of limitations for fraud is 2 years. And if you go back to that case, it bases its theory on the fact that fraud is an action on a debt. So I submit that the recent Court of Appeals opinion just didn't do its homework thoroughly enough. It cited the 2-year statute, and you can look at the 2-year statute, and I don't find anything there that could conceivably be applied to frauds. The court was relying on old law. There are some cases out there. There are lawyers that are looking to guidance for this court on the statute of limitations for fraud question, and that is another reason why I think this court should address it and clarify it for the lawyers of the state. For these reasons, then, because the language of the statute is clear, the court has no choice but to follow the language of the statute, and under the facts of this case, the cause of action was not barred by limitations, we respectfully request that this court reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals and reinstate the judgment of the trial court in favor of Mr. Williams.
Does either counsel desire additional time for supplemental briefing?
For a supplemental briefing?
Yes. You seem to be citing cases that were not in the brief, and I just wondered...
I would, Your Honor, particularly because of the new issue of the 2-year statute, but more importantly to set forth the cases that I mentioned today.
All right. Well,
and if counsel fires supplemental brief, I'd like a chance to respond, Your Honor.
All right. A week from Monday for you and 1 week thereafter.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. That concludes the argument in the first call. The court will take a brief discussion.